be addressed as much to the enemy listening in as to them. We are undertaking at Dien Bien Phu a battle in which the whole fate of the Indochina War will be decided. We have taken some pretty hard blows and have been losing many men, but those have been replaced immediately by 2 airborne battalions. There are 5 more of them ready to jump in. Our artillery is intact and ready for all protective fire missions. Guns, as well as artillerymen, have been parachuted in. Hence, the reinforcements which have arrived amply make up for our losses. The Viets can't say as much about their own. You may perhaps be surprised at not seeing more bombers, but it must be understood that the present weather does not permit all sorts of missions. At the very first clearing of the sky, all of the air power available in Indochina will be above Dien Bien Phu. Everything rides on us here. A few more days, and we shall have won, and the sacrifices made by our comrades shall not have been made in vain. Signed, De Castries. De Castries' personal feelings were expressed in a 2-line telegram which he sent at 1730 to Hanoi. Personal to General Coigny. Present situation requires permanent stationing of 1 battalion on airborne alert. Signed, De Castries. Coigny replied at 22:25 in an equally laconic message informing De Castries that he had only 1 more parachute battalion left in North Vietnam and that there were only 2 more available throughout Indochina. The atmosphere on that third day of the battle was described on pieces of paper a French combat photographer added to rolls of exposed film that left Dien Bien Phu during the next few days on one of the ambulance aircraft. The photographer, Jean Perrault, was a survivor of the Nazi concentration camps and a seasoned observer, not given to overstatements and dramatics. His reaction to Dien Bien Phu on March 16th was as follows. Airdrop of March 16th. Viet Minh bombardment of DZ and of GONO. Cavalcade of soldiers under fire. Our artillery smashed up by Viet Minh. Attempt at embarkation of wounded under fire of Viet Minh 105s. Tragic. Many wounded. Gloomy atmosphere reminds of German concentration camps. Catastrophic. The notes were supposed to have been delivered in Hanoi to another journalist, François Sully, who later reported another Vietnam War for Newsweek, but Sully never received the note and only parts of the film. I found the notes 10 years later in the French military archives, marked with a red rubber stamp and the word "Saisi" seized. The French military censors in Hanoi had decided that their immediate release would have been too demoralizing. Earlier that evening, a communist officer under a flag of truce had approached Strongpoint en Marie and left a letter addressed to De Castries stating that on March 17th in the morning, 86 wounded survivors from Gabriel would be left to be picked up 600 meters to the north of Amery 2. This offer, as well as others which were to follow at least for a while, put De Castries in a cruel dilemma. It was obviously impossible for purposes of morale to refuse to take back his own wounded, but on the other hand, the limited medical facilities of Dien Bien Phu were almost hopelessly overcrowded, and the chances of evacuating anyone were almost nil. Even though they performed incredible feats of courage, the flimsy and underpowered helicopters of the period were capable of picking up only a handful of wounded, and, as will be seen, the transport planes would soon be unable to land. The enemy knew this as well as De Castries did. Hence, the return to French lines of French casualties was coupled with not only the Viet Minh's refusal to allow the landing of ambulance aircraft, but also their refusal to accept the return of their own wounded. General Giap fully realized the burden which the mass of casualties would create for the French command, and had made the decision that the wounded, Viet Minh and French, would also have to play their role in the battle. In view of the appalling conditions in the hospital area, which, in spite of the Red Cross flags which marked it, had become a favorite target of the enemy artillery, Major Groin, on March 17th, attempted to propose to De Castries the establishment of a neutral medical village between Dien Bien Phu and Isabelle, where French and Viet Minh medical personnel would impartially care for the casualties of both sides. The idea was forwarded by De Castries to Hanoi and apparently rejected. It is not clear to this day whether that decision was made unilaterally by the French or after rejection by the enemy high command. Wednesday, March 17, 1954. In the morning, before the fog began to lift, a brief message came in from the artillery officer stationed at an OP on Aumarie 2, saying, "The Thai are getting the hell out of here." Indeed, without fuss and without much noise, the Thai mountaineers of Aumarie 1 and 2 were slipping away through the barbed wire and the openings in the minefields towards their beloved mountains on the horizon. The action had come so suddenly and so quietly that the French officers and NCOs, and the few remaining faithful Thai, had not been able to hold them back. Indeed, why hold them back at all? Obviously, they would have disintegrated under the first serious attack. As leaflets found in the trenches were to show, the communists had done their propaganda job through the best possible channels, the civilian population. Incredible as it may seem, many of the villages surrounding the French positions had not been fully evacuated. On orders of de Castries, they were to be fully evacuated by March 20th. It was a daily occurrence to see womenfolk from the partisan units and from the two mobile field bordellos and from the Mayo tribesmen of the French Central Intelligence Detachment do their marketing at Bon Comai or Bon Loi. There they would be met by other tribesmen from the communist areas who brought communist propaganda with them. Needless to say, some of these tribesmen were trained spies, who found it simple to re-enter Dien Bien Phu with the returning civilians. The partial desertion of the 3rd BT, soon followed by the total demoralization of the 2nd BT, and of many of the men of the remaining Thai light companies, was a major victory of communist psychological warfare, for it cost the French almost one-fifth of their garrison, without the communists having fired a shot. Aumarie 4, held by Captain Desiree's 9th Company, was the only one which stood fast, as the remaining French and Thai elements from AM-1 and AM-2 began to fall back at about 1400. From AM-3, Captain Guilleminot telephoned Desiree to tell him things weren't going well, but that he could hold with the Legionnaires. On questioning from HQ GONO, Desiree affirmed that he could guarantee the defense of AM-4 for at least 24 hours. By nightfall, the question as to whether the northern positions of Aumarie were to be retaken and held by the newly arrived paratroopers had become academic. The Viet Minh now rapidly pushed forward to seize the last shreds of high ground which the French held to the north of the airfield. In fact, because of the artillery bombardment that had been maintained all day on the northern sector of Aumarie, the retreating French cadres had been unable to take with them the heavy weapons of the battalion installed in the forward positions. It is curious that the 3rd BT, which had fought extremely well the previous year in the fortified position of Nassan and had distinguished itself in operations against the 320th Division in difficult terrain only a few months before, now fell apart after scarcely 2 days of fighting at Dien Bien Phu. The fact that the battalion's dependents were now partly in communist hands may have played a part. However, it is more than likely that the recent change in battalion commanders, communist psychological warfare, and the unaccustomed pressure of continuous enemy artillery bombardment in a fixed position, there was Viet Minh artillery at Nassan, but not remotely of such density, must have played a decisive role. The final question that remains is why de Castries did not use part of his reconstituted airborne reserve to retake the precious piece of high ground, which had been lost under far less honorable conditions than either Beatrice or Gabriel. De Castries' answer appears to have been that the defense of Aumarie might have cost him heavy casualties, which he could not have readily replaced since Cogny had informed him that he could, for the time being, count only on one more airborne battalion. Furthermore, there was strong evidence that the next push might be against the vital remaining high ground east of the Nam Yum, where Algerian and Moroccan troops were also showing signs of battle fatigue. De Castries and Longley therefore decided not to make a fight for Aumarie 1 and 2, but to attach Aumarie 3 and 4 to Strongpoint Huguette as of 2000 that night. Aumarie 3 became known as Huguette 6, and Aumarie 4 became Huguette 7. March 17th had also been a bad day in the air. The poor weather had kept aerial resupply at a minimum, and the communists were now covering all possible drop zones with intermittent artillery fire. The last remaining repairable Cricket reconnaissance plane had finally been found in its pit by the enemy gunners and set afire, and the Air Force's gasoline and ammunition storage dumps had been exploded by enemy artillery. At 1500, however, the exhausted medical personnel of Dien Bien Phu were relieved to see the flawless drop of Airborne Surgical Team, ACP, No. 6, under Lieutenant Vidal, M.D. Their arrival permitted Dr. Gawain to install a hospital annex on the other bank of the Nam Yum, thus saving the seriously wounded a dangerous trip across the open bridge. But Dr. Gawain's big problem, still, was the wounded who could not be evacuated. Here, the enemy had selected his action for maximum effect. He would hold his fire until the trucks, with huge Red Cross flags flying, would arrive on the airfield and approach the ambulance aircraft wheeling to a standstill. Then, when both the airplane and the wounded were at their most vulnerable, communist artillery would open up in full force, and the airplane would roar off, either empty or loaded with the more able-bodied wounded, or even some unharmed cowards trying frantically to leave the valley. Even so, two C-47s made it. One, piloted by Captain Cornu, rapidly dumped off essential medical supplies and picked up 32 men instead of the 24 the plane was supposed to carry. The other aircraft, commanded by Captain Dard, landed in the middle of a heavy artillery barrage at 1900 and waited for 5 minutes on the ground before taking off again empty. Not one of the ambulance trucks had been able to approach the airstrip. At noon, Dien Bien Phu had had a visitor. General Cogny had flown over the fortress for a full half hour, observing the battle. It was said later that the sight of the martyred fortress plowed under by the constant rain of communist shells, and to judge from the tenor of its command communications in an obvious state of low morale, inspired Cogny with the idea that he should land, when possible, and direct the battle, just as his own mentor, the late Marshal de Lattre, had done in 1951 during the battle for Vignennes. At Vignennes, de Lattre had landed in a cricket reconnaissance aircraft in the middle of a French encircled unit, and, faced with the pleas of his chief of staff that he was in mortal danger, had superbly replied, "Come and get me out." In defending Cogny's ultimate decision not to do so, Jules Rat has argued that Dien Bien Phu was not Cogny's work, but Navarre's. To risk his life for it would have been tantamount to admitting that he was responsible for Dien Bien Phu. This argument, in my view, is specious. As commander of the Northern Theater, where Dien Bien Phu was located, Cogny was responsible for its defense, even if he had not personally picked Dien Bien Phu. The deployment of the artillery, the improvised character of the counterattacks, the poor use of the reserves, and the poor choice of the units assigned to Dien Bien Phu were his responsibility and his alone. The available documentation and statements subsequently made by Cogny or Navarre in no way changed this fact. As soon as Cogny had made his decision not to resign, but to continue to lead a battle of which he apparently now fully disapproved, he assumed a historical responsibility, which can be evaded only with difficulty. Thursday, March 18, 1954. The supply problems that Dien Bien Phu faced turned from bad to worse. The enemy artillery now crowned all the heights around the valley, and communist 37mm anti-aircraft guns began to fire directly into the takeoff and landing patterns of the airstrip from the newly conquered positions on top of Gabriel and Almerie. One of the major problems of nighttime supply drops was that the garrison was not yet geared to the complicated problem of collecting and distributing over 100 tons of diverse cargo within a few hours. At 01:25 of March 18th, Dien Bien Phu suggested to Hanoi that henceforth it would be simpler to parachute supplies directly on the strong points rather than on the DZs. The fog-shrouded morning hours always provided the weary garrison with some respite, since there was light enough to do the most essential chores without being seen by the enemy observers. 1st Company of the 5th BPVN, under Lieutenant Rondeau, took advantage of the fog to relieve Captain Desiree's 9th Thai Company on what was now Huguette 7, and Desiree, on holding a roll call for his men, noticed with satisfaction that only 3 were not accounted for. Methodically, his men packed up for the 10-kilometer march southward to Isabelle, their new assignment. On the airfield, the Moroccans of the 31st Engineering Battalion used the morning respite to repair the pierced steel plates of the airfield. Enemy shells had hacked it to pieces until there were only 600 meters of it left. After some hasty hammering and welding under intermittent, if blind, artillery fire, the airfield was again usable to the 1,000-meter limit. On March 19th, further exposed scraping and patching would make it again operable to the 1,500-meter limit. The work of the combat engineers paid off. At 10:55, an ambulance aircraft piloted by Lieutenant Biswang succeeded in landing and picking up 23 wounded who had been lying in open slit trenches along the taxi strip. Major Dard came in close behind and had begun to roll on the field when he was boxed in by a salvo of mortar explosions which riddled the rear of the aircraft and seriously wounded a doctor who was aboard. Two helicopters from the 1st Light Helicopter Evacuation Company suffered a similar fate. The first landed directly near the main hospital and was able to embark one wounded man. Another helicopter attempted a landing at the CP of Mobile Group 9, where Lieutenant Colonel Gaucher had been killed 5 days earlier, but was waved off before it could land. That night, Major Jacques Guérin hit upon a solution to the night landing problem, which temporarily permitted the evacuation of a large number of wounded. One French C-47 would act as a decoy and fly a low-level airdrop pattern over the valley, which was sure to attract the attention of most of the enemy's anti-aircraft gunners. At the same time, a blacked-out aircraft would attempt to glide into the airport with propellers almost feathered and with only very few directional lanterns to guide him on the strip. Among the pilots, there were heated arguments as to whether it was more dangerous to play decoy or to land on the darkened airfield in the middle of artillery fire. Yet the ruse worked until March 27th, when a parachute flare, fired from a mortar of Huguette 6 at the wrong moment, brilliantly lit up the runway and gave away the scheme to the communists. At least 223 wounded had been picked up in this manner, and 101 were evacuated by helicopters, providing the sorely taxed hospitals of the valley with at least a brief respite. On the ground, communist pressure had changed in character. With the outer defenses of Dien Bien Phu solidly in Viet Minh hands, General Giap decided to switch to more economical siege techniques. Thousands of coolies began to arrive in the valley and were soon at work digging the huge communications trench system designed to eventually surround the fortress completely. At 1525, De Castries informed Hanoi that trenches dug only 1 kilometer south of Strongpoint Elian now had reached the Nam Yum, thus cutting off the best direct road between Dien Bien Phu and Isabelle. As night fell and the artillery fire slackened off, the French outposts could hear the noise of picks and shovels around Dominique 1 and 2, northwest of Elian, and again to the south of it. The noise of entrenching also came closer to Huguette and Claudine in the west, as well as to the north of Isabelle. Until now, Isabelle had operated as a dependency of Dien Bien Phu and had relied heavily on the daily convoys which continued to hack their way through communist ambushes, bring in wounded and picking up supplies. Now, the sealing off of Isabelle became highly likely. Friday, March 19, 1954. During the night, helicopters and C-47s had evacuated a total of 36 wounded under heavy fire. The heavy C-19 flying boxcars of the American-operated Civil Air Transport Company now were dropping huge pallet loads of 1 ton or more, and while this was efficient in terms of utilization of aircraft and pilot potential, the huge loads proved totally unmovable by hand under fire. The problem was further complicated when such a load, usually containing ammunition and other explosives, fell into a minefield and blew up together with it, or when, because of a parachute failure, the load plowed into a French entrenchment or dugout with all the impact of a heavy bomb. As a result, Dien Bien Phu requested at 2038 that henceforth only smaller loads be dropped whenever possible. These, it was proposed, should be limited to individual packages of 100 kilograms or less. On the ground, strangulation began. New trenches were discovered 600 meters west of Claudine, and now even the smallest patrol sorties ran into heavy infantry fire. The effect on the morale of the lonesome De Castries can be guessed from a message which he sent at 1500 on a top-secret and personal basis to General Cogny. He envisioned the early fall of Dien Bien Phu, which would be shortly followed by the inevitable fall of Isabelle. De Castries then requested authorization for Lieutenant Colonel Lalande and his men at Isabelle to blow up their artillery and to make a break in the direction of Muang Khoa and Muang Sai in Laos. Cogny's reply message was noncommittal on the issue itself and contained a modicum of encouragement for the future. "You are right in envisaging at your command level even the most catastrophic hypotheses. Shall give you the indications concerning same, but am quite certain that you shall be successful thanks to your will to resist on the spot, communicated to the important effectives under your command in their improved positions, and to your spirit of aggressiveness, communicated to the internal counterattack forces, as well as to those devoted to preventive outside action, SICK, whose aim it is to hamper enemy forces on their line of departure. In warm friendship, Kuan Yi. Here again, one may well suspect that the message was sent for purposes of being inserted in the future historical record, or simply to help De Castri over a very difficult psychological moment. Nevertheless, it was obviously unrealistic in terms of conditions inside the fortress. While the effectives were important, they were at most one-fourth those of the enemy. The French positions, far from having been improved, except in the sense that under heavy communist artillery fire, everybody now was digging deeper and better trenches and dugouts, had lost most of the vital high ground that had made Dien Bien Phu viable. And as for counterattacks and preventive outside action, these would have taken more men and more artillery and more air support than De Castri could have mustered in his wildest dreams. Yet it was obvious that Kuan Yi now realized the gravity of the command crisis at Dien Bien Phu. He was to return to the same theme during the following days. He also would provide De Castri with senior officers to replace those lost during the first week of battle. On the night of March 19th, a small squadron of 5 transports, led by Lieutenant Colonel Descavet, succeeded in picking up 95 wounded, the largest number thus far. Earlier during the day, another rescue operation had taken place. Helicopters marked with Red Cross insignia had picked up the uninjured pilots of Fighter Group 122, Saint-Ange, isolated at Dien Bien Phu since their airplanes were destroyed in mid-March. This clear-cut violation of the Red Cross Convention certainly did not escape the Viet Minh forward observers. The commander of the French helicopter group was later to remark that the Viet Minh had at first abstained from firing on medevac helicopters or aircraft until they saw the pilots embarking, then immediately began firing on the second wave of helicopters. "That serious violation on the French side," said the report, "was to cost us later 2 helicopters and crews, and was used as pretext by the enemy for firing on other Red Cross planes." Yet the violations continued, as the French brought in Lieutenant Colonel de Crew, De Castri's new chief of staff, Lieutenant Colonel Lemounier, the new commander of GM9, and Colonel Vallion, the artillery commander replacing Pirot, by ambulance, helicopter, or aircraft. While it is doubtful, as the Viet Minh charged, that ambulance aircraft attempted to land everything but medical supplies, the verified violations of the Red Cross rules gave the communists a welcome pretext for ignoring them as well. On March 23rd, when General Navarre addressed an open radio message to Giap, in which he called him General for the first time, asking for protection of medical aircraft and, if necessary, their inspection by an international Red Cross commission, his offer was met with stony silence from Giap. Moreover, Voice of Vietnam propaganda broadcasts charged the French with bringing in ammunition in ambulance planes. Late that night, De Castri decided to expel the Thai population from the surrounding villages in the valley as of March 20th, both to save it from the increasingly heavy bombardment and to prevent further infiltration of intelligence agents into the camp. This did not end the presence of civilians on the battlefield or even inside Dien Bien Phu. The 8th Commando Group, GC8, of Captain Hébert, which was the local unit of the French Central Intelligence Services, supervised a small group of Mayo tribal operatives, whose wives and children were no longer able to slip back to their native areas. The evacuation of the wives and families of the men of GMPT to Hanoi also was no longer possible. Finally, there were 2 bordels mobiles de campagne, mobile field brothels. One was made up of Algerian girls from the Oulad Nail tribe, the other of Vietnamese girls. Both shared the trials of the garrison. The presence of civilian elements was to add to the tensions inside the camp, and in the end, the fate of the civilians was to be far worse than that of the soldiers. During the night of March 19th to 20th, leaflets in French and Arabic fell on Strongpoint Dominique, inciting the Algerians of the 3-3 RTA to abandon the cause of the French imperialists. Saturday, March 20th, 1954. March 20th was a calm day, save for intermittent artillery fire. In Hanoi, General Co Nhi continued to be concerned by what he felt to be a morale crisis among the senior commanders at Dien Bien Phu. Early in the morning, he sent to Castries a new 5-point directive, of which, curiously enough, two somewhat different versions exist. The first was provided by Co Nhi to Ra, and the second is contained in the French War Archives. The directive, with alternate modifications, reads as follows. 1. Above all, one must keep in view the success of the battle. 2. An airborne regimental group is being speedily activated, but its commitment must be reserved to the exploitation of the success. 3. The only immediate possibility is to reinforce you by one battalion in order to compensate your losses suffered during the counterattacks, but even the dropping of that battalion can only be permitted on the condition that the integrity of the fortified camp be guaranteed. 4. Any strong point upon which the Viet Minh would set foot must be retaken from the enemy on the spot. Alternate text, be retaken by an immediate counteroffensive with your own means at hand. 5. In the unfortunate and infinitely improbable hypothesis which has been considered, here the alternate text specifically refers to de Castries' telegram of the previous day, an eventual operation for the rescue of the breakout force has been studied. Here again, the difference between the situation at hand and its appearance in Hanoi is striking. A guarantee of the integrity of what was left of the position of Dien Bien Phu was totally meaningless under the circumstances. The dictum to retake any lost strong point on the spot, softened to immediately in the text apparently transmitted to Dien Bien Phu, also meant very little in view of the vastly superior enemy infantry and firepower that overwhelmed strong points Beatrice and Gabriel. It has been said that the messages of March 19th and 20th, and those which followed within the next few days, were designed to lift the spirits of the local command. If this was so, they failed. The recipients were to say later that they were irritated by what they thought was a lack of appreciation of the precariousness of their situation. The opening of the road between Isabelle and Dien Bien Phu ran into relatively little trouble at the communist roadblock at Ban Co Lai. Yet it cost 5 dead, 2 missing and 5 wounded, including 2nd Lieutenant Alain Gambiez, son of General Gambiez, Navarre's chief of staff. By chance, General Gambiez that same evening flew over Dien Bien Phu in the headquarters aircraft, making its daily rounds over the valley, coordinating supply flights and air support. Gambiez insisted that his son not be the object of particular solicitude, but be flown out only when his proper turn came. At 22:43, with most of the urgent radio traffic out of the way, personnel at Dien Bien Phu reminded personnel at Hanoi that it was still in urgent need of more artillery specialists, particularly a crew for the 155mm howitzer that had been wiped out by Viet Minh counter-battery fire. Sunday, March 21, 1954. A sharp blast awoke the camp at 0300 as a Viet Minh commando unit, which had sneaked right past the patrols and strong points of Huguet, blew a hole in the airstrip near Huguet 1. Patrols had been seen on the airfield before, but not so close to the central position. On Dominique, things had been unquiet. Enemy leaflets had been replaced by open letters addressed by name to the Algerian sergeants. Later, leaflets and loudspeaker appeals in German were to follow. The enemy was trying to soften up the non-French elements of the garrison. Moreover, the listening posts, sonnets or doorbells, far out in the no-man's land beyond Huguet, Dominique, and Elian, began to report contacts with enemy patrols. To the south, at Isabelle, the legionnaires had another arduous day attempting to break through to the main position. Slowly, the enemy stranglehold at Ban Co Lai and Ban Hong Nai became increasingly tighter. It now took the tank platoons of both Warrant Officer Carette and Lieutenant Perrault to effect the breakthrough at 16:55, instead of the usual noon hour. Nevertheless, de Castries, mindful of Cogny's exhortations and personally willing to stay on the offensive as long as possible, decided to attempt major forays for the following day. A strong task force centered on the 1st BEP under the command of Captain Vieux, supported by the now-grounded French Air Force detachment of Captain Charnot, fighting surprisingly well as infantry, and by Algerians with tanks from Isabelle, attempted to mop up the Ban Co Lai roadblock. In addition to artillery support, the Air Force had allocated 88 combat missions for the operation. Even before the sortie began on Sunday evening, Major Bijard had taken his veteran 6th BPC northward out of Dominique along Road 41 on an armed reconnaissance to verify reports of a dangerous enemy buildup in the area. The day ended where it had begun, on the airfield. At 2200, a patrol of bearded Legionnaire sappers from 12 REI's headquarters company ran into a Viet Minh patrol and engaged it in a firefight without noticeable results. At midnight, after a C-47 from Transport Group 264, Bayern, made a successful blind landing and was in position for takeoff with a full load of wounded, when Viet Minh infiltrators shot the pilot, Lieutenant Arbelé, in the legs. Both he and his cargo of wounded were returned to Dr. Gouin's hospital. At 2300, a patrol consisting of a corporal and 2 legionnaires disappeared in the no-man's land between Huguette 7 and Tiny Francoise. It was never heard from again. Monday, March 22, 1954. By dawn, Bijard's paratroopers were under heavy pressure. They had run into strong enemy elements very close to Dominique and were pinned down. Casualties would be severe if the enemy found them in the open after the morning fog had lifted. Soon the battalion mortars were involved in the fight, followed by the howitzers of the 2-4 RAC. Bijard now carefully extricated his men from the trap. To the west, a patrol from 1st Company, 5th BPBN, reported enemy occupation of the abandoned strongpoints on Marie 1 and 2, which brought Huguette 7 into full enemy view. The siege ring was apparently airtight throughout the whole northern area. How tight it was to the south would be disclosed later in the day. In the meantime, the foggy morning hours were being put to good use elsewhere in the camp. Lieutenant Arbelé, his legs heavily swathed in bandages, was rolled back to the airport along with the men wounded the night before and managed to get his aircraft back to Hanoi despite Viet Minh fire. A 15-man group of artillerymen from the 35th Airborne Artillery Regiment, led by Lieutenant Zickel, was airdropped on Isabelle as reinforcements for the 310 RAC. The mop-up operation at the Viet Minh blocking position of Ban Co Lai began at 07:30. At first, it proceeded with incredible smoothness. No enemy opposition could be found. However, as the leading elements reached Ban Co Lai, the strangulation tactics of the enemy were dramatically revealed. Each day, the Viet Minh around Dien Bien Phu added to what was to become a ring of trenches surrounding the fortress. It soon became clear that the 1st BEP, even though reinforced by a tank platoon under Sergeant Ney, would not be able to force the roadblock alone. Elements of the 2-1 RTA, Algerian Rifles, from Isabelle, were thrown into the fight, followed by Isabelle's tank platoon and riflemen from the Thai subgroupment WIM. Nevertheless, the 2 enemy companies dug in at Ban Co Lai fought to the last ditch. It was only when the French committed the remaining 4 tanks of the squadron at Dien Bien Phu that they finally succeeded in joining hands with the Isabelle force at 1200. It was the first French victory in the valley of Dien Bien Phu. The enemy had paid for it dearly. There were only 9 survivors of one of the companies of Regiment 57 which had held the trenches at Ban Co Lai. On the French side, losses had also been heavy, 151 dead, including 3 Foreign Legion paratroop lieutenants, 72 wounded, and 1 man missing. At 2305, Airborne Surgical Team No. 3 at Isabelle radioed for an urgent drop of 3 gallons of fresh blood, 50 pair of surgical gloves, 100 tubes of catgut, and more surgical equipment. Obviously, the road to Isabelle was becoming a meat-grinder operation, which the French could not indefinitely afford. At de Castries' command post and General Cogny's headquarters in Hanoi, the mosaic of aerial photographs of the valley taken daily by reconnaissance aircraft of the 80th Overseas Reconnaissance Squadron, EROM, began to tell the story of the tight network of trenches that were beginning to strangle Dien Bien Phu. Older officers, who had served in World War I, recalled their knowledge of trench warfare, mine galleries, and countermines dug under the enemy's trench systems. Cogny ordered de Castries to prepare to wage counter-trench warfare. In a personal telegram on the afternoon of Monday, March 22, de Castries informed Cogny that he lacked specialists in combat engineering equipment for trench warfare. On the following day, he requested 4 copies of regulations on the defensive organization of terrain and other documents on trench warfare. It was only on March 23rd that De Castri issued orders that all strongpoints had to be interconnected with communications trenches and that light nighttime reconnaissance parties should mine and booby-trap the newly dug enemy trenches. Tuesday, March 23rd, 1954. The following day, two helicopters from the Laotian base at Muang Sai attempted to pick up wounded from Isabel in the midst of an artillery barrage. The pilot of the first landed right on top of the hospital because he had a letter for Dr. Resilot. In view of the heavy artillery fire falling, he was told to leave immediately without waiting to pick up any wounded. As he lifted off, the second helicopter of the flight, apparently neither of them checked in with Dien Bien Phu air control before making their approach, settled down on the landing area just vacated by the first helicopter. Its pilot, Warrant Officer Henri Bartier, ran into the hospital dugout and picked up Lieutenant Gambiez. He was lifting off when a volley of enemy shells disintegrated the lead helicopter. The same fragments also hit the rear fuselage of Bartier's craft, which descended heavily and broke into flames. Bartier, who had recently flown his 1,000th combat mission in Indochina and who had rescued 250 men with his helicopter, was pulled from the helicopter. But it was too late for Lieutenant Gambiez. The magnesium alloy of the aircraft burned fiercely, and the young lieutenant was incinerated with it. Still another helicopter landed at Dien Bien Phu and succeeded in bringing in a new senior officer, Lieutenant Colonel Voineau, who was to command the western sector of Dien Bien Phu, that is, Huguette and Claudine. Later that day, Lieutenant Colonel Longley escorted the newly arrived Colonel Lemounier and Colonel Voineau on an inspection tour to Isabel. Escorted by Captain Jean Senel's Algerians from Isabel, they had no trouble with communist roadblocks that day. Apparently, People's Army Regiment 57 was still licking its wounds. Late in the afternoon, the garrison was treated to the French Air Force's Operation Neptune, a massive napalm bombardment of the enemy trench positions around Dien Bien Phu. While the sheets of flame and black smoke creeping over the hills were impressive, the application of napalm on a waterlogged rainforest seemed of dubious efficacy. A few minutes after the end of the barrage, ground observers reported that the napalm had burned, but had not set spreading fires. The following morning, headquarters at Dien Bien Phu reported laconically that the effort had not yielded observable results. Undeterred, the Air Force launched Operation Aeol on the stretch of Road 41 leading into the valley of Dien Bien Phu. This effort did not yield observable results either. Wednesday, March 24, 1954. At 07:10 in the morning of March 24th, Lieutenant Colonel Keller, De Castri's chief of staff, who had broken under the strain, was embarked on an ambulance aircraft. De Castri now had to face the battle with an entirely new group of subordinates. Yet this was to become irrelevant, since De Castri was no longer leading the battle. He had withdrawn from his men and even from his staff. While it is untrue, as some people later asserted, that De Castri sat in his well-protected bunker wearing a steel helmet, as Keller had done, it is nonetheless a fact that he rarely left his underground headquarters. Jules Roy was to say of De Castri that he acted as if a spring had broken inside him. When Longley appeared before the French government commission investigating the Battle of Dien Bien Phu in 1955, he described De Castri's role in the battle laconically. He transmitted our messages to Hanoi. What happened at Dien Bien Phu on March 24th has never been fully explained, but it seems that Longley's reply to the investigation commission was not a quip, it was the truth. According to senior officers who were eyewitnesses to part of the drama, Lieutenant Colonel Longley, flanked by the fully armed commanders of the paratroop battalions at Dien Bien Phu, entered De Castri's office and bluntly told him that henceforth the effective command of the fortress would be in his own hands, but that as far as the outside world was concerned, De Castri would retain the appearance of command and would serve as an intermediary between the paratroop commanders and Hanoi. It is odd that until now, this situation, which was well known to a fairly sizable group of senior officers both at Dien Bien Phu and in Hanoi, has remained publicly unmentioned. None of the published works on Dien Bien Phu mentions it, although Longley, at the end of his own book, makes a significant reference to the scope of his own responsibilities, which would be excessive were it not for the fact that he had de facto command of Dien Bien Phu after March 24th. Though I was only a simple paratroop lieutenant colonel at the beginning of the battle, I had directly under my orders 10,000 men, but nobody in Hanoi or elsewhere sought to deprive me of that handsome command. It would nonetheless have been easy to get to Dien Bien Phu with a parachute on one's back, or, up to March 29th, even by landing there. I was in the damned valley up to my neck, and I stayed in it to the bitter end. In view of the subsequently excellent personal relations between Long Lay and De Castri, it is difficult to describe what happened on March 24th as a mutiny or a putsch by what some staff officers called the paratroop mafia or Long Lay's brain trust. Actually, there was no formal takeover of constituted authority, nor did De Castri protest the change. To paraphrase a senior officer who was there, GAP-2 logically took the place of a command organization that no longer existed, and exercised prerogatives whose effective usage the commander of the fortress had ceased to exercise. Only one senior officer, the newly arrived Colonel Boineau, attempted to resist the reorganization of the command structure ran through by Long Lay. Long Lay walked into the map room and allegedly threw a glass of whiskey in Boineau's face and told him and everyone else within earshot to come outside and settle the matter man to man if he disagreed with the reorganization. No one did. Long Lay later apologized to Boineau for the rashness of his gesture, and the two worked together in harmony until the end of the battle. The same courtesy and friendship prevailed between Long Lay and De Castri. To the end, Long Lay remained, along with Le Mounier and Boineau, one of De Castri's nighttime bridge partners. The reorganization of the Dien Bien Phu command established the following structure. Long Lay was now in charge of the whole defense, and Le Mounier was his deputy. Dien Bien Phu itself was subdivided into two subsectors whose limit was the Nam Yum. The key eastern subsector, Dominique and Elian, was directly commanded by Long Lay from the headquarters of Mobile Group 9, while Lieutenant Colonel Boineau took command of the western subsector, the lowland part of Dien Bien Phu, from the headquarters of the former command post of Colonel Troncar's northern sector. Troncar, whom Long Lay blamed for the loss of Gabrielle and Almarie, remained at the disposal of De Castri. Seguin Passy retained command of GAP-2, while the tough Bijar became Long Lay's deputy for intervention, that is, the counterattacks. Long Lay reserved for himself the use of the tanks and the quad-50s. All counterattacks had to be cleared with him. The mission assigned to the western subsector was to maintain the integrity of the lowland strongpoints, to give itself air during the day and ears at night, that is, to stay on the offensive during the day and to be watchful at night, and to ensure the protection of the airstrip and of the aircraft attempting to land on it. Signed by De Castri himself, this order was one of the last written documents to reach Hanoi before Dien Bien Phu was sealed off forever. From the marginal comments made by Cogny's headquarters, it is obvious that its real portent was misunderstood. To be sure, Hanoi was surprised by Long Lay's increased responsibility, but only for bureaucratic reasons, such as the fact that in his functions of commander of the eastern subsector, Long Lay would theoretically be under the command of Le Mounier, his own deputy, junior in rank by 1 year. The staff noted that the order did not spell out any combat directives for the eastern subsector, which Long Lay was to command himself, and an unknown hand wrote on the original document, "Long Lay himself must have written that order." The comment, as Long Lay was to tell this writer 10 years later, was correct. It is difficult to this day to assess what effect the change of command had on the battle itself. Looking back from the distance of a decade, Seguin Passy felt, and Long Lay was to confirm this to a certain extent in his own writings, that De Castri exercised a beneficial influence on the conduct of the defense. Between Long Lay, who saw salvation only in staying constantly on the offensive no matter how high the cost, and De Castri, who saw salvation in lasting long enough to be rescued from the outside, the battle alternated between obstinate defense, as best shown in the ensuing battle for the Huguette positions, and determined offensive, as in the battles for the Elion Hills. A constant example of the compromises between De Castri and Long Lay was the use of flare ships, aircraft dropping parachute flares, over the battlefield. Long Lay often demanded that the flare ships stop their work, because they interfered with his battle, while De Castri just as insistently demanded that they continue to operate at the same time because they facilitated his logistics. When the choice had to be made between airplane tonnage for troops or for supplies, Longley usually opted for troops, observing that ammunition would do him no good without combatants, while de Castries, with equal justice, would argue that troops without ammunition would do little good either. In any case, the opposing forces in the Battle of Dien Bien Phu were finally led by a French lieutenant colonel, who, in effect, commanded a whole division, and by a Vietnamese history professor, who, in effect, commanded a whole army. The day also brought another long letter from General Cogny for Colonel de Castries, which merely underlined the world of unreality that prevailed in Hanoi. It was another document to be on file for the historical record. In it, Cogny assured de Castries that the enemy had suffered heavy losses, was finding it difficult to find replacements for his depleted units, and was experiencing logistical difficulties, particularly in the field of ammunition and rice. "The rainy season, now close at hand," said Cogny, "will compromise his communication lines and will oppose a major obstacle of mud to the development of his field fortifications." The exact opposite was true. The monsoon rains gave communist supply convoys added protection against roving French aircraft and further compromised the efficacy of the French support system, which now depended entirely on parachuted reinforcements and supplies. The communist trenches and field fortifications around Dien Bien Phu were in every case either far higher on the mountain slopes than those of the French, or at least, as south of Claudine and Elian, at the same level with them. The communist artillery, deeply buried in the hillsides, occupied positions that could not be weakened by waterlogging, whereas the French dugouts and underground shelters would collapse more readily from the effects of rain than from communist artillery shells. Cogny reiterated his promise to de Castries of an airborne battalion, but hedged his additional promise of another airborne battle group until "the enemy, disintegrating from or exhausted by your aggressive resistance, shall abandon the game." As for the problems of airborne resupply for Dien Bien Phu, Cogny felt that even continued occasional landings of aircraft, particularly light aircraft and helicopters from Muang Sai, would remain feasible. Cogny also suggested that the enemy's attack plans on Dien Bien Phu be kept off balance as much as possible, and that his intelligence about the French order of battle be confused by the building of phony artillery positions and the periodical displacement of field pieces to alternate gun pits. When this order reached Dien Bien Phu, the landing of helicopters and light aircraft had become nearly impossible. The last C-47 to take off intact from Dien Bien Phu became airborne on March 27th. The last helicopter or light aircraft left the valley on the last day of the month. As for the digging of phony gun emplacements and confusing enemy intelligence estimates, it made little sense in a position in which every available yard of terrain was already crammed with infantry, depots, and artillery pieces. Moreover, every available French infantryman and combat engineer was frantically working to maintain or improve existing field fortifications. Also, communist observers with ordinary field glasses could read every French daytime movement like an open book, and, in any event, a steady trickle of prisoners and deserters assured enemy intelligence of a constant flow of fresh information. "And thus," continued Cogny, "you will repel the attack until the day when the monsoon season will make it impossible." Cogny then went on to explain to de Castries that in order to avoid strangulation, he should, as a matter of first priority, try to suppress the enemy flak, and should attempt offensive infantry stabs, to push further back those two audacious artillerymen and those two enterprising infantrymen. Cogny must have realized that the French at Dien Bien Phu would also suffer from the rains. Yet with a blitheness of style that is hard to render in translation, he recommended that de Castries transfer the center of gravity of the whole position from the lowlands west of the Nam Yum to the hill line on the east, as if the battles for blood-drenched Beatrice and the steep jungle hills to the east of Elian had never occurred, and as though the 312th and 316th People's Army Divisions were mathematical abstractions. As for the French artillery at Isabelle, Cogny made one recommendation. Since the guns were emplaced to fire towards Dien Bien Phu, it would be easy to protect them by burying them deeply in the ground in casemates. The fact that there was not a square plank of wood available at Isabelle apparently never occurred to General Cogny. Moreover, Isabelle was under constant artillery fire. Lastly, he admonished de Castries constantly to keep two full battalions in reserve, if not possibly three. This recommendation was made when Longley had exactly one mixed company of foreign legionnaires and paratroopers under Captain Philippe as his total reserve for all of Dien Bien Phu. Cogny concluded by assuring de Castries that the full application of the directive would assure him of victory. "You shall therefore win. You shall delay the attack, you shall win the defensive battle, and you shall break out of Dien Bien Phu. You will then go over to the exploitation phase, for, at the very least, you will be able to reduce the strength of your organization and to proceed with the relief of the units who will have well merited it." The second phase of the battle was about to begin. On the morning of the 24th, the foreign legionnaires of the 12REI had discovered communist trenches approaching the barbed wire of Huguette 6 to a distance of barely 50 meters and had gone out with tanks to fill them in. Later in the day, the 6th BPC, supported by the tank platoon of Sergeant Ney, again proceeded with the opening of the road ceremonial in the direction of Isabelle, only to be caught in yet another communist roadblock at Bonhomme-Pet. This time, the communists were ready to deal with the tanks. A well-aimed rocket from a Viet Minh bazooka damaged tank Pajin, which had to be towed back to base. At 1600, a transport aircraft was caught by enemy flak and crashed in a rice field. The entire crew was lost. Later, a depot of 120mm mortar shells was hit by enemy fire and exploded with an earth-shaking roar. Thursday to Saturday, March 25th to 27th, 1954. When dawn broke on the 25th of March, the communist trenches around Dominique had grown tentacles, particularly around D1 and D6. D6 had become so precarious that Longley decided to pull out the depleted 2nd Company of the 5th Vietnamese Parachute Battalion and to cover the area by flanking fire from the higher positions of D1 and D2. On March 24th, Viet Minh soldiers arrived on top of D6. A counterattack by 4th Company of the 5th BPBN, after a short artillery barrage, reoccupied it. On March 25th, D6 was further reinforced by 3rd Company, which took up a position on it to cover the flank of Major Touré's 8th Parachute Assault Battalion, which was attempting to clear the approaches to D1. A firefight ensued when the enemy attacked the paratroopers. To the south of Dominique, Guiraud's 1st BEP and the rest of Botella's 5th BPVN, supported by Ney's tank platoon, also were in the process of clearing Viet Minh penetrations from around Elian 4. Perrault, the French army photographer, participated in the action, and his photographs of it were probably the last French pictures to leave the valley. His scribbled notes of the day clearly indicate an improvement in the morale of the garrison. Assault of the trench with hand grenades, brought on a barrage of Viet Minh grenades, firing by our tanks, terrific atmosphere. I must have some very nice photos. Ran out of 35mm film. 2 Dakotas shot down by VM anti-aircraft guns. Film, for me, no doubt given to pilot of 2nd shot down plane. Morale excellent. Farther to the south, it was the turn of Major Nicolas Moroccans to open the road to Isabelle. Near Bon Loi, they found Viet Minh bunkers, and Warrant Officer Caret's tank platoon was summoned. It finally took the arrival also of the tank platoon from Isabelle to reopen the road to the south. Far to the north, where the airfield lay, an endless desert in comparison to the cramped quarters of the rest of Dien Bien Phu, an Air Force detachment under Master Sergeant Perak frantically inched its way forward in broad daylight to one of the transport planes which had been shot down but which had not burst into flames. Of the 6 men in the rescue squad, 4, including Perak, were wounded by communist shell fragments. Yet they succeeded in pulling the dazed crew out of the aircraft before the communist gunners destroyed it. Beyond the airfield, Huguette 6 and 7 were leading their solitary existence 3 kilometers from the center of Dien Bien Phu and separated from it by the lonely expanse of the airfield. Viet Minh trenches were now closing in. In fact, the situation had become so critical that on the 26th, 2 companies of the 1st BEP, reinforced by the 2 full tank platoons, counterattacked to fill in the trenches strangling Huguette 6. On the 27th, H7 had to be cleared in the same manner by the Thai mountaineers of 2nd BT under Major Chanel. Unlike the Thai of 3rd BT, who had abandoned Almerie a week earlier, 2nd BT was still firm. However, its position on the inner flanks of Elion had never been as exposed as that of 3rd BT, and it had not been as exposed to communist propaganda as 3rd BT. But while the battle ground on, so did the smaller wheels of military bureaucracy. Very little that happened at Dien Bien Phu gave rise to humor, but two amusing events took place on March 26th. The French army in Indochina, in deference to its many Muslim servicemen, had for years run a small airlift through the Muslim holy city of Mecca. Since, according to the Muslim faith, a man who had accomplished the Hajj, pilgrimage, was assured of a partial remission of his sins in the hereafter and of the consideration of his fellow soldiers and citizens in the meantime, these pilgrimages were much sought after. It was therefore not entirely surprising when Sergeant Sadok, a Moroccan from the 31st Engineers, received a routine telegram informing him that he had received leave to go immediately on a pilgrimage to Mecca. Grenier, another sergeant in the same battalion, had a difficult problem. His term of enlistment had expired, and, in view of the situation at Dien Bien Phu, he was not of a mind to extend it. He therefore refused to re-enlist. The French army, on the other hand, found it difficult to repatriate him. Nevertheless, the sergeant adamantly refused to sign up. He thus became the only civilian doing combat duty there. The personnel section in Hanoi sent a bureaucratic radio message to the engineers on March 26th to the effect that although Sergeant Grenier has arrived at the term of his enlistment, his refusal to extend his tour of duty does not seem to call for administrative action right now. The unfortunate man received a shell fragment in his chest on April 16th. Finally, that day, the 155s of the counter-battery scored heavily. 3 out of 4 75mm howitzers of a communist battery, dubbed by the French JY, and situated 2 kilometers east of Isabelle, were destroyed by direct hits. There would be few such lucky hits throughout the battle. Meanwhile, the massacre of transport planes continued. 1 Dakota, piloted by Captain Vauglin, was shot down west of Ouguette on the evening of March 26th, but its crew was saved. The aircraft itself burned like an enormous funeral pyre for hours. On March 27th at 0700, Captain D'Artigue succeeded in landing his Dakota No. 267 and taking on a full load of wounded. He brought them safely to Hanoi and immediately started for a second run, only to be shot down at 1000 on the approach run across Elian. The whole crew perished. At 1750, another Dakota from Transport Group 263 Senegal plowed into the ground west of Claudine. It burned like a torch. Sergeant Perrac and his rescue crew raced under shellfire across the airfield, the barbed wire, and the mines around Claudine, dragging their carbon dioxide fire extinguishers, but they were too late. The entire crew had perished. Later that evening, 1 last transport aircraft, piloted by Captain Bougereau, managed to land at Dien Bien Phu and to pick up 19 wounded who had been waiting anxiously in the drainage ditch near the airfield's taxi stand. The plane took off in a rain of mortar shells. Its crew, which like all the ambulance aircraft in Indochina included a French women's Air Force nurse, did not know it, but theirs was the last flight to take off safely from the fortress. That evening, 2 men made decisions about the tragic situation of the transport aircraft over Dien Bien Phu. One of them was Colonel Nicot, the air transport commander in Hanoi. The other was Colonel de Castries. Nicot fired off a message at 1930 to General Lauzun, the commander-in-chief of the French Far Eastern Air Force. "It is hardly necessary to insist on the necessity of stopping that carnage. But the air crews, in addition to an obvious physical fatigue, have suffered a psychological shock. It is necessary to immediately stop low-level parachute drops, and I have given the order to do so as of tonight." For the C-47s, this meant that the daytime parachute drop altitudes went from 2,500 feet to 6,500 feet, and later, as enemy flak became even more proficient and largely equipped with Soviet 37mm guns, to 8,500 feet. In turn, this meant that parachuted loads had to be equipped with powertrain delays whose small explosive charge would open the parachutes at a preset altitude. The first experiences with the delayed drops were disastrous because complete loads either fell into enemy hands or the delay failed to open at all and the cargo impacted inside Dien Bien Phu like a bomb. De Castries also had to face the fact that Dien Bien Phu was going to die, and die rapidly, if he did not succeed in temporarily silencing the enemy's anti-aircraft fire, which was reducing his whole logistical support system to a shambles. It is not clear whether de Castries acted on his own initiative or upon an admonition from Hanoi, but on March 27th at 1900, he called in Major Bijard for the planning of a limited offensive against a nest of communist light flak near Banong Pet, about 2.5 kilometers west of Claudine. With gentlemanly understatement, de Castries said to the barrel-chested major, whom he did not yet know too well, "My little Bruno," Bijard's alias from French resistance days, "you will have to go out and get me that Viet flak out west. When do you want it?" "Tomorrow. You have carte blanche. Take everything you need and orchestrate the business any way you wish." "All right," said Bijard. "I'll do it, but I would like to make a few remarks. You'll have to accept some pretty serious losses among the best units you've got, and you are leaving me very little."